Bel Canto by Anne Patchett. For Carl van de Vender. Fonti e colline e chiesi agli dei. Mudiro al fine, pago io vovro. Ne mai quel fonte co desir miei, ne mai quel monte trapassero. I asked the gods for hills and springs. They listened to me at last. I shall live contented, and I shall never desire to go beyond that spring, nor shall I desire to cross that mountain. Se ariete uno, malinconia ninfa gentile. Vincenzo Bellini.
Sprecher, ihr Fremdlinge, was sucht oder fordert in von uns?
Tamino, Freundschaft und Liebe.
Sprecher, bist du bereit, es mit deinem Leben zu erkämpfen?
Tamino, ja. Speaker, Stranger, what do you seek or ask from us? Tamino, friendship and love. Speaker, and are you prepared even if it costs you your life? Tamino, I am. Chapter 1. When the lights went off, the accompanist kissed her. Maybe he had been turning towards her just before it was completely dark. Maybe he was lifting his hands. There must have been some movement, a gesture, because every person in the living room would later remember a kiss. They did not see a kiss. That would have been impossible. The darkness that came on them was startling and complete. Not only was everyone there certain of a kiss, they claimed they could identify the type of kiss. It was strong and passionate, and it took her by surprise. They were all looking right at her when the lights went out. They were still applauding, each on his or her feet, still in the fullest throes of hands slapping together, elbows up. Not one person had come anywhere close to tiring. The Italians and the French were yelling, "Brava, brava!" and the Japanese turned away from them. Would he have kissed her like that had the room been lit? Was his mind so full of her that in the very instant of darkness he reached for her, did he think so quickly? Or was it that they wanted her too, all of the men and women in the room, and so they imagined it collectively? They were so taken by the beauty of her voice that they wanted to cover her mouth with their mouth. Drink in. Maybe music could be transferred, devoured, owned. What would it mean to kiss the lips that had held such a sound? Some of them had loved her for years. They had every recording she had ever made. They kept a notebook and wrote down every place they had seen her, listing the music, the names of the cast, the conductor. There were others there that night who had not heard her name. Who would have said, if asked, that opera was a collection of nonsensical cat screechings? That they would much rather pass 3 hours in a dentist's chair. These were the ones who wept openly now, the ones who had been so mistaken. No one was frightened of the darkness. They barely noticed. They kept applauding. The people who lived in other countries assumed that things like this must happen here all the time. Lights go on, go off. People from the host country knew it to be true. Besides, the timing of the electrical failure seemed dramatic and perfectly correct, as if the lights had said, "You have no need for sight. Listen." What no one stopped to think about was why the candles on every table went out as well, perhaps at that very moment or the moment before. The room was filled with the pleasant smell of candles just snuffed, a smoke that was sweet and wholly unthreatening, a smell that meant it was late now. Time to go to bed. They continued the applause. They assumed she continued her kiss. Roxanne Koss, lyric soprano, was the only reason Mr. Hosokawa had come to this country. Mr. Hosokawa was the reason everyone else had come to the party. It was not the kind of place one was likely to visit. The reason the host country, a poor country, was throwing a birthday party of unreasonable expense for a foreigner who had to be all but bribed into attending was that this foreigner was the founder and chairman of Nansei, the largest electronics corporation in Japan. It was the fondest wish of the host country that Mr. Hosokawa would smile on them, help them in some of the 100 different ways they needed helping. That could be achieved through training or trade. A factory, and this was the dream so dear its name could hardly be spoken, could be built here, where cheap labor could mean a profit for everyone involved. Industry could move the economy away from the farming of coca leaves and black-hearted poppies, creating the illusion of a country moving away from the base matter of cocaine and heroin, so as to promote foreign aid and make trafficking of those very drugs less conspicuous. But the plan had never taken root in the past, as the Japanese by nature erred on the side of caution. They believed in the danger, and the rumors of danger, countries such as this presented. So to have Mr. Hosokawa himself, not an executive vice president, not a politician, come and sit at the table was proof that a hand might be extended, and maybe that hand would have to be coaxed and begged, maybe it would have to be pulled from its own deep pocket. But this visit, with its glorious birthday dinner replete with opera star, with several meetings planned and trips to possible factory sites tomorrow, was a full world closer than they had ever come before, and the air in the room was sugared with promise. Representatives from more than a dozen countries who had been misled as to the nature of Mr. Hosokawa's intentions were present at the party. Investors and ambassadors who might not encourage their governments to put a dime into the host country, but would certainly support Nansei's every endeavor, now circled the room in black tie and evening gown, making toasts and laughing. As far as Mr. Hosokawa was concerned, his trip was not for the purposes of business, diplomacy, or a friendship with the president, as later would be reported. Mr. Hosokawa disliked travel and did not know the president. He had made his intentions, or lack of intentions, abundantly clear. He did not plan to build a plant. He would never have agreed to a trip to a strange country to celebrate his birthday with people he did not know. He was not much for celebrating his birthday with people he did know, and certainly not his 53rd, which he considered to be a number entirely without note. He had turned down half a dozen strong requests from these very people for this exact party, until the promised gift was the presence of Roxanne Koss. And if she was the present, who would decline? No matter how far away, how inappropriate, how misleading it might prove to be, who would say no? But first remember another birthday, his 11th, the birthday on which Katsumi Hosokawa first heard opera, Verdi's Rigoletto. His father had taken him to Tokyo by train, and together they walked to the theater in a steady downpour. It was October 22nd, and so it was a cold autumn rain, and the streets were waxed in a paper-thin layer of wet red leaves. When they arrived at the Tokyo Metropolitan Festival Hall, their undershirts were wet beneath coats and sweaters. The tickets waiting inside Katsumi Hosokawa's father's billfold were wet and discolored. They did not have especially good seats, but their view was unobstructed. In 1954, money was precious. Train tickets and operas were unimaginable things. In a different time, such a production would have seemed too complicated for a child, but this was only a handful of years after the war, and children then were much more likely to understand a whole host of things that might seem impossible for children now. They climbed the long set of stairs to their row, careful not to look down into the dizzying void beneath them. They bowed and begged to be excused by every person who stood to let them pass into their seats, and then they unfolded their seats and slipped inside. They were early, but other people were earlier, as part of the luxury that came with the ticket price was the right to sit quietly in this beautiful place and wait. They waited, father and son, without speaking, until finally the darkness fell and the first breath of music stirred from some place far below them. Tiny people, insects, really, slipped out from behind the curtains, opened their mouths, and with their voices gilded the walls with their yearning, their grief, their boundless, reckless love that would lead each one to separate ruin. It was during that performance of Rigoletto that opera imprinted itself on Katsumi Hosokawa, a message written on the pink undersides of his eyelids that he read to himself while he slept. Many years later, when everything was business, when he worked harder than anyone in a country whose values are structured on hard work, he believed that life, true life, was something that was stored in music. True life was kept safe in the lines of Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, while you went out into the world and met the obligations required of you. Certainly he knew, though did not completely understand, that opera wasn't for everyone, but for everyone he hoped there was something. The records he cherished, the rare opportunities to see a live performance, those were the marks by which he gauged his ability to love, not his wife, his daughters, or his work. He never thought that he had somehow transferred what should have filled his daily life into opera. Instead, he knew that without opera, this part of himself would have vanished altogether. It was early in the second act when Rigoletto and Gilda sang together, their voices twining, leaping, that he reached out for his father's hand. He had no idea what they were saying, nor did he know that they played the parts of father and daughter. He only knew that he needed to hold to something. The pull they had on him was so strong he could feel himself falling forward out of the high and distant seats. Such love breeds loyalty, and Mr. Hosokawa was a loyal man. He never forgot the importance of Verdi in his life. He became attached to certain singers, as everyone does. He made special collections of Schwarzkopf and Sutherland. He believed in the genius of Callas above all others. There was never a great deal of time in his days, not the kind of time such interest clearly merited. Custom was that after having dinner with clients and completing paperwork, he would spend 30 minutes listening to music and reading librettos before falling asleep. It was impossibly rare, maybe 5 Sundays a year, that he found 3 consecutive hours to listen to one opera start to finish. Once in his late 40s he ate a spoiled oyster and suffered a vicious bout of food poisoning that kept him home for 3 days. He remembered this time as happily as any vacation, because he played Handel's Alcina continually, even while he slept. It was his eldest daughter, Kiyomi, who bought him his first recording of Roxanne Koss for his birthday. Her father was a nearly impossible man to buy gifts for. And so when she saw the disc, and a name she did not recognize, she thought she would take a chance. But it wasn't the unknown name that drew her, it was the woman's face. Kiyomi found the pictures of sopranos irritating. They were always peering over the tops of fans or gazing through veils of soft netting. But Roxanne Koss looked at her directly. Even her chin was straight, her eyes were wide open. Kiyomi reached for her before she even noticed it was a recording of Lucia de Lammermoor. How many recordings of Lucia de Lammermoor did her father own? It didn't matter. She gave her money to the girl at the counter. When Mr. Hosokawa put the CD in the player and sat down in his chair to listen, he did not go back to work that night. It was as if he was a boy in those high seats in Tokyo again, his father's hand large and warm around his own. He set the disc to play over and over, skipping impatiently past anything that was not her voice. It was soaring, that voice, warm and complicated, utterly fearless. How could it be at once controlled and so reckless? He called Kiyomi's name, and she came and stood in the doorway of his study. She started to say something, yes or what or sir, but before she could make out the words, she heard that voice. The straight-ahead woman from the picture. Her father didn't even say it. He simply gestured towards one speaker with his open hand. She was enormously pleased to have done something so right. The music praised her. Mr. Hosokawa closed his eyes. He dreamed. In the 5 years since then, he had seen 18 performances featuring Roxanne Koss. The first was a lucky coincidence. The other times he went to the city where she would be, creating business to take him there. He saw La Sonnambula 3 nights in a row. He had never sought her out, or made himself to be anything more than any other member of the audience. He did not assume his appreciation for her talent exceeded anyone else's. He was more inclined to believe that only a fool would not feel about her exactly how he felt. There was nothing more to want than the privilege to sit, and listen. Read a profile of Katsumi Hosokawa in any business magazine. He would not talk in terms of passion, as passion was a private matter. But opera was always there. The human interest angle to make him appear more accessible. Other CEOs were shown fly fishing in Scottish rivers or piloting their own Learjets into Helsinki. Mr. Hosokawa was photographed at home in the leather chair he sat in when he listened, a Nansei EX-12 stereo system behind him. There were the inevitable questions about favorites. There was the inevitable answer. For a price that was considerably more than the entire cost of the rest of the evening, food, service, transportation, flowers, security, Roxanne Koss was persuaded to come to the party, as it fell in between the end of her season at La Scala and the beginning of her appearance at Teatro Colón in Argentina. She would not attend the dinner, she did not eat before she sang, but would arrive at the end of the meal and perform 6 arias with her accompanist. Mr. Hosokawa was told by letter that he could make a request upon accepting the invitation, and while the hosts could make no promises, the request would be given to Miss Koss for her consideration. It was Mr. Hosokawa's selection, the aria from Rusalka, which she had just completed when the lights went out. It was to be the end of the program, though who is to say if she might have sung an encore, or even 2, had the lights remained on. Mr. Hosokawa chose Rusalka as a measure of his respect for Miss Koss. It was the centerpiece of her repertoire, and would require no extra preparation on her behalf, a piece that surely would have been included in the program had he not requested it. He did not seek something achingly obscure, an aria from Partenope, perhaps, so as to prove himself an aficionado. He simply wanted to hear her sing Rusalka while standing close to her in a room. If a human soul should dream of me, may he still remember me on awaking. His translator had written it out for him from the Czech years ago. The lights stayed off. The applause began to show the slightest downward sweep. People blinked and strained to see her again. A minute passed, then 2, and still the group remained comfortably unconcerned. Then Simon Thibault, the French ambassador, who had, before coming to this country, been promised the much more desirable post of Spain, which had been unfairly given to another man as a payoff for a complicated political favor while Thibault and his family were packing, noticed the lights beneath the kitchen door were still on. He was the first to understand. He felt like he had been startled from a deep sleep, drunk from liquor and pork and Dvorak. He took his wife's hand, reached up for it in the darkness as she was still applauding, and pulled her into the crowd, dark bodies he could not see, but pushed himself into. He went towards the direction of the glass doors he remembered being at the far end of the room, craning his head to try and catch a glimpse of starlight for orientation. What he saw was the narrow beam of a flashlight. One, and then another. And he felt his heart cave down inside his chest. A feeling that could only be described as sadness. Simon, his wife whispered. It was already in place, without him seeing any of it. The web was spun and snug around the house, and while his first impulse, the natural impulse, was to press ahead anyway and see if he might beat out the odds, clear logic held him. Better not to draw attention to yourself, better not to be an example. Somewhere in the front of the room the accompanist was kissing the opera singer, and so Ambassador Thibault drew his wife Edith into his arms. "I'll sing in the dark," Roxanne Koss called out. "If someone will get me a candle." With these words the room stiffened and the final moment of applause turned to silence, as it was noted that the candles, too, were dark. It was the end of the evening. By now the bodyguards napped inside limousines like great overfed dogs. All across the room, men slipped their hands into pockets and found only neatly pressed handkerchiefs and folding money. A surge of voices went up, there was some shuffling, and then, as if by magic, the lights came on. It had been a beautiful party, though no one would remember that. White asparagus and hollandaise, a fish course of turbot with crispy, sweet onions, tiny chops, only 3 or 4 bites apiece in a cranberry demi-glaze. Usually, struggling countries longing to impress the heads of important foreign corporations chose Russian caviar and French champagne. Russian and French, Russian and French, as if that was the only way to prove prosperity. On every table, sprays of yellow orchids, each flower no bigger than a thumbnail, all locally grown, trembled and balanced like mobiles, rearranging themselves with every exhalation of a guest. The effort that had gone into the evening, the positioning of each stem, the sweeping calligraphy of the place cards, had been lost without a moment's appreciation. Paintings had been borrowed from the National Museum. A dark-eyed Madonna presenting a tiny Christ on her fingertips, his face oddly knowing and adult, was placed over the mantel. The garden, which the guests would see only for a moment when they walked the short distance from their cars to the front door, or if they happened to glance out the window while it was still light enough, was polished and composed. Birds of paradise and tightly wrapped canna lilies, banks of lamb's ear and emerald fern. They were not far from the jungle, and even in the most domesticated garden, the flowers strained to overtake the dull stretch of neat Bermuda grass. From early in the morning, young men had worked, wiping the dust from the leathery leaves with damp cloths, picking up the fallen blossoms of bougainvillea that rotted beneath the hedges. 3 days before, they had put a fresh coat of whitewash on the high stucco wall that surrounded the home of the vice president, careful that none of the paint should fall on the grass. Every element was planned. Crystal salt cellars, lemon mousse, American bourbon. There was no dancing, no band. The only music would be after dinner. Roxanne Koss and her accompanist, a man in his 30s from Sweden or Norway with fine yellow hair and beautiful tapering fingers. 2 hours before the beginning of Mr. Hosokawa's birthday party, President Masuda, a native of this country born of Japanese parents, had sent a note of regret saying that important matters beyond his control would prevent him from attending the evening's event. There was great speculation about this decision after the evening turned bad. Was it the president's good luck? God's divine will? A tip-off? Conspiracy? Plot? Sadly, it was nothing so random. The party was scheduled to begin at 8 o'clock and should have lasted past midnight. The president's soap opera began at 9. Among the president's cabinet members and advisers, it was an open secret that matters of state could not be held Monday through Friday for 1 hour, beginning at 2 in the afternoon, or Tuesday evening for 1 hour, beginning at 9. Mr. Hosokawa's birthday fell on a Tuesday this year. There was nothing that could be done about that. Nor could anyone conceive how to have a party that commenced at 10 o'clock at night, or had concluded by 8:30, and which allowed time for the president to return home. It was suggested that the program could be taped, but the president abhorred taping. There was enough taping to endure when he was out of the country. All he asked of anyone was that certain hours of his week remain unquestionably open. The discussion of the problem of Mr. Hosokawa's ill-timed birthday party lasted for days. After a great deal of negotiating, the president relented and said he would attend. Hours before the party began, for an obvious and unstated reason, he firmly, irrevocably changed his mind. While President Masuda's commitment to his programs was completely known and acknowledged by his political inner circle, this commitment somehow managed to remain utterly unknown to the press or the people. The host country was mad for soap operas, and yet the president's unwavering devotion to his television set was so potentially embarrassing, his cabinet would have gladly traded it in for an indiscreet mistress. Even members of the government who were themselves known to follow certain programs could not bear to see the obsession played out so rigidly in their head of state. So for many of the people at the party who worked with the president, his absence was noted with disappointment and no real surprise. Everyone else inquired, "Has there been an emergency? Is President Masuda unwell?" "Matters in Israel," they were told confidentially. "Israel," they whispered. They were impressed, never dreaming that President Masuda would be consulted on matters in Israel. There was a clear division among the almost 200 guests that night. those who knew where the president was and those who didn't, and so it remained until both sides forgot about him altogether. Mr. Hosokawa barely noticed the absence. He cared very little about meeting the president. What could a president possibly mean on the evening one would meet Roxanne Koss? Into the presidential void, the vice president, Ruben Iglesias, stepped forward to host the party. This was not so difficult to imagine. The dinner was being given in his home. Throughout the cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, the sit-down dinner and the creamy singing, his mind stayed on the president. How easy it was to picture his running mate now, as Iglesias had seen him 100 times before, sitting in the dark on the edge of the bed in the master suite of the presidential palace, his suit jacket folded over the arm of a chair, his hands folded and pressed between his knees. He would be watching a small television that sat on his dresser, while his wife watched the same program on a large screen in the den downstairs. A picture of a beautiful girl tied to a chair reflected in his glasses. She twisted her wrists back and forth, over and over again, until suddenly she found some slack in the rope and slid one hand free. Maria was free! President Masuda rocked back and clapped his hands silently. To think he had almost missed this after waiting for weeks. The girl glanced quickly around the storeroom and then leaned forward to untie the coarse rope that bound her ankles. Then, in an instant, the picture of Maria was gone. And Ruben Iglesias lifted his face to the light which was suddenly restored to his living room. He had just begun to register that a bulb was burned out on a side table lamp when men burst into the party from every window and wall. Everywhere the vice president turned, the edges of the room seemed to push forward, yelling. Heavy boots and gun butts pounded through vents, stormed in through doors. People were thrown together and then just as quickly broke apart in a state of animal panic. The house seemed to rise up, like a boat caught inside the wide arm of a wave, and flip onto its side. Silverware flew into the air, the tines of forks twisting against knife blades. Vases smashed into walls, people slipped, fell, ran, but only for an instant, only until their eyes readjusted to the light, and they saw the utter uselessness of their fight. It was easy to see who was in charge, the older men, the ones shouting orders. They did not introduce themselves at the time, and so for a while they were thought of not by their names but by their most distinctive features. Benjamin, raging shingles. Alfredo, mustache, first and second fingers missing on left hand. Hector, gold wire glasses that had lost one arm. With the generals came 15 soldiers who ranged in age from 20 to 14. There were now an additional 18 people at the party. No one there could count them at the time. They moved and spread. They doubled and tripled as they pulsed around the room, appeared from behind curtains, came down from upstairs, disappeared into the kitchen. They were impossible to count because they seemed to be everywhere. Because they were so similar, like trying to count bees in a swarm around your head. They wore faded clothing in dark colors, many in the dull green of shallow, sludgy ponds. A handful in denim or black. Over their clothing they wore a second layer of weapons, sashes of bullets, flashy knives in back pockets, all manner of guns. Smaller guns holstered to thighs or sticking up hopefully from belts, larger guns cradled like infants, brandished like sticks. They wore caps with the bills pulled down, but no one was interested in their eyes, only their guns, only their shark-toothed knives. A man with 3 guns was recorded subconsciously as 3 men. There were other similarities between the men. They were thin, either from the wanting of food or just the business of growing. Their shoulders and knees poked at their clothing. They were also dirty, noticeably so. Even in the confusion of the moment, everyone could see that they were smudged and streaked, arms and faces and hands mottled in dirt, as if they had arrived at the party by digging up through the gardens and dislodging a panel in the floor. This entrance could not have taken more than a minute, and yet it seemed to last longer than all 4 courses of dinner. There was time for every guest to consider a strategy, revise it thoroughly, and abandon it. Husbands found wives who had drifted to the other side of the room. Countrymen sought out their own and stood in blocks, speaking rapidly to one another. It was the consensus of the party that they had been kidnapped not by La Familia de Martín Suárez, so named for a boy of 10 who had been shot dead by the government's army while passing out flyers for a political rally, but by the much more famous terrorists, La Dirección Auténtica, a revolutionary group of murderers whose reputation had been built over 5 years of wide-ranging brutality. It was the unspoken belief of everyone who was familiar with this organization, and with the host country, that they were all as good as dead, when in fact it was the terrorists who would not survive the ordeal. Then the terrorist missing two fingers, who was wearing wrinkled green pants and a mismatched jacket, raised the large .45 caliber auto and fired two rounds into the ceiling. A splattering of plaster dislodged and dusted a portion of the guests, at which point several of the women screamed, either from the firing of the gun or the touch of something unexpected on their bare shoulders. "Attention," the man with the gun said in Spanish. "This is an arrest. We demand absolute cooperation and attention." Roughly, two-thirds of the guests looked frightened, but a scattered third looked both frightened and puzzled. These were the ones leaning towards the man with the gun, instead of away from him. These were the ones that did not speak Spanish, they whispered quickly to their neighbors. The word atención was repeated in several languages. That word was clear enough. General Alfredo had anticipated his announcement bringing about a sort of pricked, waiting silence, but no silence came. The whispering caused him to fire into the ceiling again, carelessly this time, hitting a light fixture, which exploded. The room was dimmer, and slivers of glass settled into shirt collars and rested on hair.
"Arresto!" he repeated. "Detengase!"
It may seem surprising at first. Such a large number of people, unable to speak the language of the host country. But then you remember it was a gathering to promote foreign interest, and the two guests of honor did not know 10 words of Spanish between them, although arresto made logical sense to Roxanne Koss and meant nothing to Mr. Hosokawa. They leaned forward as if it might make understanding easier. Miss Koss was not leaning far, as the accompanist had wrapped himself around her like a security wall, his body ready, anxious, to step in front of any bullet that might stray in her direction. Gen Watanabe, the young man who worked as Mr. Hosokawa's translator, leaned over and spoke the words in Japanese to his employer. Not that it would have done him any good in these present circumstances, but Mr. Hosokawa had once tried to learn Italian from a set of tapes he listened to on airplanes. For business purposes, he should have learned English, but he was more interested in improving his understanding of opera. "Il bigliettaio mi fece il biglietto," the tape said. "Il bigliettaio mi fece il biglietto," he mouthed back silently, not wanting to disturb the other passengers. But his efforts were minimal at best, and in the end he made no progress. The sound of the language spoken made him long for the sound of the language sung, and soon he was slipping Madama Butterfly into the CD player instead. When he was younger, Mr. Hosokawa saw the great advantage of languages. When he was older, he wished he had made the commitment to learn them. The translators, they were ever-changing, some good, some full of schoolboy stiffness, some utterly, hopelessly stupid. Some could hardly speak their native Japanese and continually halted conversations to look up a word in a dictionary. There were those who could perform their job well enough, but were not the sort of people one wished to travel with. Some would abandon him the moment the final sentence of a meeting was completed, leaving him stranded and mute if further negotiations were necessary. Others were dependent, wanting to stay with him through every meal, wanting to accompany him on his walks and recount for him every moment of their own lusterless childhoods. What he went through just for a mouthful of French, a few clear sentences of English, what he went through before Gen. Gen Watanabe had been assigned to him at a conference on the worldwide distribution of goods in Greece. Normally, Mr. Hosokawa tried to avoid the surprise element local translators so often provided, but his secretary had been unable to locate a Greek translator who could travel on short notice. During the plane ride to Athens, Mr. Hosokawa did not talk with the 2 senior vice presidents and 3 sales managers who accompanied him on the trip. Instead, He listened to Maria Callas sing a collection of Greek songs on his Nansei headset. Thinking philosophically, if the meeting was unintelligible to him, at least he would have seen the country she considered her home. After waiting in line to have his passport stamped and his luggage rifled through, Mr. Hosokawa saw a young man holding a sign, Hosokawa, neatly lettered. The young man was Japanese, which frankly was a relief. It was easier to deal with a countryman who knew a little Greek than a Greek who knew a little Japanese. This translator was tall for being Japanese. His hair was heavy and long in the front, and it brushed across the top rims of his small round glasses even as he tried to keep it parted to one side. He appeared to be quite young. It was the hair. The hair denoted to Mr. Hosokawa a lack of seriousness. Or perhaps it was just the fact that the young man was in Athens rather than Tokyo that made him seem less serious. Mr. Hosokawa approached him, gave the slightest bow of acknowledgement that only included his neck and upper shoulders, a gesture that said, "You have found me." The young man reached forward and took Mr. Hosokawa's briefcase, bowing as he did so, to the waist. He bowed seriously, though somewhat less deeply, to both of the vice presidents and the three sales managers. He introduced himself as the translator, inquired after the comfort of the flight, gave the estimated driving time to the hotel, and the starting time of the first meeting. In the crowded Athens airport, where every second man seemed to sport a mustache and an Uzi, among the jostling of bags and the din of shouting and overheard announcements, Mr. Hosokawa heard something in this young man's voice, something familiar and soothing. It was not a musical voice, and yet it affected him like music. "Speak again." "Where are you from?" Mr. Hosokawa asked.
"Nagano City, sir."
"Very beautiful. And the Olympics?" Gen nodded, contributing no information about the Olympics. Mr. Hosokawa struggled to come up with something else. It had been a long flight, and it seemed that in the time he had been on the plane, he had forgotten how to make conversation. He felt it should be incumbent upon Gen to attempt to draw him out.
"And your family, are they still there?"
Gen Watanabe paused for a moment as if he were remembering. A swarm of Australian teenagers passed them, each with a knapsack strapped to her back. Their shouts and laughter filled the concourse.
"Wombat!"
one girl cried out, and the others answered. "Wombat! Wombat! Wombat!" They stumbled in their laughter and clung to each other's arms.
"They're all there,"
Gen said, eyeing the backs of the teenagers with cautious suspicion.
"My father, mother, and two sisters."
"And your sisters, are they married?"
Mr. Hosokawa did not care about the sisters, but the voice was something he could almost place, like the notes opening the first act of...
"What?"
Gen looked at him directly.
"Married, sir."
Suddenly this dull question took on the edge of something inappropriate. Mr. Hosokawa looked away while Gen took his luggage and led his party through the sliding glass doors into the blasting heat of Greece at noon. The limousine waited, cool and idling, and the men climbed inside. Over the next 2 days, everything Gen touched became a smooth surface. He typed up Mr. Hosokawa's handwritten notes, took care of scheduling, found tickets to a performance of Orfeo ed Eurydice that had been sold out for 6 weeks. At the conference, he spoke in Greek for Mr. Hosokawa and his associates, spoke in Japanese to them, and was, in all matters, intelligent, quick, and professional. But it was not his presence that Mr. Hosokawa was drawn to. It was his lack of presence. Gen was an extension, an invisible self that was constantly anticipating his needs. He felt Gen would remember whatever had been forgotten. One afternoon during a private meeting concerning shipping interests, as Gen translated into Greek what he had just that moment said himself, Mr. Hosokawa finally recognized the voice. Something so familiar. That's what he had thought. It was his own voice.
"I don't do a great deal of business in Greece," Mr. Hosokawa said to Gen that night over drinks in the bar of the Athens Hilton.
The bar was on top of the hotel and looked out over the Acropolis. and yet it seemed that the Acropolis, small and chalky in the distance, had been built there for just this reason, to provide a pleasant visual diversion for the drinking guests.
I was wondering about your other languages. Mr. Hosokawa had heard him speaking English on the phone.
Gen made a list, stopping from time to time to see what had been left out. He divided into categories the languages in which he felt he was extremely fluent, very fluent, fluent, passable, and could read. He knew more languages than there were specialty cocktails listed in the plexiglass holder on the table. They each ordered a drink called an Areopagus. They toasted. His Spanish was extremely fluent. Half a world away in a country twice as foreign, Mr. Hosokawa was remembering the Athens airport, all the men with mustaches and Uzis who called to mind the man who held the gun now. That was the day he met Gen, 4 years ago, five. After that, Gen came back to Tokyo to work for him full-time. When there was nothing that needed translating, Gen simply seemed to take care of things before anyone knew they needed taking care of. Gen was so central to the way he thought now that Mr. Hosokawa forgot sometimes he didn't know the languages himself, that the voice people listened to was not his voice. He had not understood what the man with the gun was saying, and yet it was perfectly clear to him. At worst, they were dead. At best, they were looking at the beginning of a long ordeal. Mr. Hosokawa had gone someplace he never should have gone, let strangers believe something that was not true, all to hear a woman sing. He looked across the room at Roxanne Koss. He could barely see her. Her accompanist had her so neatly wedged between himself and the piano.
President Masuda, the man with the mustache and the gun said. There was an uneasy shifting among the well-dressed guests. No one wanted to be the one to break the news.
President Masuda, come forward.
People kept their eyes blank, waiting, until the man with the gun brought the gun down so that now it faced the crowd, though in particular it appeared to be pointed at a blonde woman in her 50s named Elise, who was a Swiss banker. She blinked a few times and then crossed her wide-open hands, one on top of the other, to cover her heart, as if this was the place she was most likely to be shot. She would offer up her hands if they might afford her heart a millisecond of protection. While this elicited a few gasps from the audience, it did little else. There was an embarrassing wait that ruled out all notions of heroics or even chivalry, and then finally, the vice president of the host country took a small step forward and introduced himself.
I am Vice President Rumen Iglesias, he said to the man with the gun.
The vice president appeared to be extremely tired. He was a very small man, both in stature and girth, who had been chosen as a running mate as much for his size as for his political beliefs. The pervasive thinking in government was that a taller vice president would make the president appear weak, replaceable.
President Masuda was unable to attend this evening. He is not here.
The vice president's voice was heavy. Too much of this burden was falling to him.
Lies,
the man with the gun corrected. Rubén Iglesias shook his head sadly. No one wished more than he that President Masuda were in attendance right now, instead of lying in his own bed, happily playing over the plot of tonight's soap opera in his mind. General Alfredo quickly turned the gun in his hand so that he now held the muzzle rather than the handle. He brought the gun back in the air and hit the vice president on the flat bone of his cheek beside the right eye. There was a soft thump, a sound considerably less violent than the action, as the handle of the gun hit the skin over the bone and the small man was knocked to the ground. His blood wasted no time in making its exit, spilling out the 3-centimeter gash near his hairline. Some of it made its way into his ear and started the journey back into his head. Still, everyone, including the vice president, now lying half-conscious on his own living room rug, where not 10 hours before he had rolled in a mock wrestling match with his 3-year-old son, was pleased and surprised that he had not been shot dead. The man with the gun looked at the vice president on the floor, and then, as if liking the sight of him there, instructed the rest of the party to lie down. For those who didn't speak the language, this was clear enough, as one by one the other guests sank to their knees and then stretched out on the floor.
Face up,
he added. The few who had done it wrong rolled over now. Two of the Germans and a man from Argentina would not lie down at all until the soldiers went and poked them sharply in the backs of their knees with rifles. The guests took up considerably more room lying down than they had standing up, and to accommodate the need for space, some lay down in the foyer and others in the dining room. 191 guests lay down, 20 waiters lay down, 7 prep cooks and chefs lay down. The vice president's 3 children and their governess were brought from the upstairs bedroom where, despite the late hour, they had yet to go to sleep, because they had been watching Roxanne Koss sing from the top of the stairs, and they too lay down. Scattered across the floor like area rugs lay some important men and women, and a few extremely important men and women, ambassadors and various diplomats, cabinet members, bank presidents, corporation heads, a monsignor, and one opera star who appeared to be much smaller now that she was on the floor. Bit by bit, the accompanist was moving on top of her, trying to bury her beneath his own broad back. She squirmed a bit. The women who believed that this would all be over shortly and they would be home in their own beds by 2 a.m. were careful to adjust their full skirts beneath them in a way that would minimize wrinkling. The ones who believed they would be shot presently let the silk wad and crease. When everyone had settled to the floor, the room was left remarkably quiet. Now the people were clearly divided into 2 groups, those who were standing and those who were lying down. Instructions were given. Those lying down were to remain quiet and still. Those standing up should check those lying down for weapons and for secretly being the president. One would think that being on the floor would make one feel more vulnerable, more afraid. They could be stepped on or kicked. They could be shot without even the chance to run. Yet to a person, everyone on the floor felt better. They could no longer plot to overpower a terrorist or consider a desperate run at the door. They were considerably less likely to be accused of doing something they did not do. They were like small dogs trying to avoid a fight, their necks and bellies turned willfully towards sharp teeth. Take me. Even the Russians, who had been whispering a plot to make a run for it a few minutes before, experienced the relief of resignation. Not a few of the guests closed their eyes. It was late. There had been wine and turbot and a very nice small chop, and as much as they were terrified, they were tired. The boots that stepped around them, over them, were old and caked in mud that flaked off into trails across the elaborately patterned Savonnier carpet, which mercifully lay on a good pad. There were holes in the boots, and the edges of toes could be seen, toes being now so close to eyes. Some of the boots had fallen apart and were held together by silver electrical tape that was itself filthy and rolled back at the edges. The young people crouched down over the guests. They did not smile, but there was nothing particularly threatening in their faces either. It was easy to imagine how this might have gone if everyone had been standing, a smaller boy with several knives needing to establish his authority over a taller, older man wearing an expensive tuxedo. But now the boy's hands moved quickly, fluttering in and out of pockets, smoothing down pants legs with their fingers spread. For the women, there was just the slightest tapping around the skirts. Sometimes a boy would lean over, hesitate, and pull away altogether. They found very little of interest, as this was a dinner party. The following items were recorded in a notebook by the very quiet General Hector. 6 silver penknives in trouser pockets, and 4 cigar cutters on watch chains, 1 pearl-handled pistol scarcely larger than a comb in an evening bag. At first they thought it was a cigarette lighter, and accidentally popped off around trying to find the flame, leaving a narrow gouge in the dining room table. 1 letter opener with a cloisonné handle from the desk, and all manner of knives and meat forks from the kitchen, the poker and the shovel from the stand by the fireplace, and a snub-nosed .38 Smith & Wesson revolver from the vice president's bedside table, a gun which the vice president freely admitted to having when questioned. All of this they locked into an upstairs linen closet. They left the watches, wallets, and jewelry. One boy took a peppermint from a woman's satin evening clutch, but first held it up discreetly for consent. She moved her head down and back just a quarter of an inch, and he smiled and slipped off the cellophane.
One boy peered intently at Gen and Mr. Hosokawa, looking once and then again at their faces. He stared at Mr. Hosokawa and then backed up, stepping on the hand of one of the waiters who winced and pulled it away quickly.
"General!"
the boy said, too loudly for such a quiet room. Gen moved closer to his employer as if to say by the position of his body that this was a package deal. They went together. Over the warm and breathing guests stepped General Benjamin. At first glance, one might have thought he had the unlucky draw of a large port wine birthmark. But with another look, it was clear that what was on his face was a living, raging thing. The bright red river of shingles began somewhere deep beneath his black hair and cut a swath across his left temple, stopping just short of his eye. The very sight of them made the viewer weak from sympathetic pain. General Benjamin followed the path of the boy's pointing finger, and he too stared at Mr. Hosokawa for a long time.
"No," he said to the boy.
He began to turn away, but then he stopped, said to Mr. Hosokawa in a conversational manner,
"He thought you were the president."
"He thought you were the president,"
Gen said quietly, and Mr. Hosokawa nodded. A Japanese man in his 50s wearing glasses. There were another half dozen lying around. General Benjamin dropped his rifle down to Gen's chest and rested the muzzle there, like a walking stick. The round opening was barely bigger than one of the studs on his shirt front, and it made a small and distinct point of pressure.
"No talking."
Gen mouthed the word traductor to him. The general considered this for a moment, as if he had just been told the man he had spoken to was deaf or blind. Then he picked up his gun and walked away. Surely Gen thought there must be some medication that man could take that would help him. When he inhaled, he felt a small piercing ache where the point of the gun had been. Not so far away, near the piano, two boys took their guns and poked at the accompanist until he was more beside Roxanne Koss than on top of her. Her hair, which had been pulled up into an elaborate twist on the back of her head, was nearly impossible to lie on. She had surreptitiously removed the pins and put them in a neat pile on her stomach where they could be collected as weapons if anyone was so inclined to take them. Now her hair, long and curled, spread out around her head, and every young terrorist made a point of coming by to see it, some being bold enough to touch it. Not the deep satisfaction of a stroke, but the smallest of taps with one finger near its curling ends. Leaning over this way, they could smell a perfume which was different from the perfumes of the other women they had inspected. The opera singer had somehow replicated the scent of the tiny white flowers they had passed in the garden on their way to the air ducts. Even on this night, with the possibilities of their own deaths and the possibilities of liberation weighing heavily on their minds, they had noticed the smell of such a tiny bell-shaped flower that grew near the high stucco wall, and now, to find it here again so soon in the hair of the beautiful woman, it felt like an omen, like good luck. They had heard her sing while they waited, crouched inside the air conditioning vent. They each had a task, extremely specific instructions. The lights were to be cut off after the sixth song, no one ever having explained in their lives the concept of an encore, no one having explained opera, or what it was to sing other than the singing that was done in a careless way under one's breath, while carrying wood into the house or water up from the well. No one having explained anything, even the generals who'd been to the capital city before, who had had educations, held their breath so as to better hear her. The young terrorists waiting in the air conditioning vents were simple people. And they believed simple things. When a girl in their village had a pretty voice, one of the old women would say she had swallowed a bird. And this was what they tried to say to themselves as they looked at the pile of hairpins resting on the pistachio chiffon of her gown. She has swallowed a bird. But they knew it wasn't true. In all their ignorance, in all their unworldliness, they knew there had never been such a bird. In the steady river of approaching boys, one crouched down beside her and picked up her hand. He held it lightly, hardly more than rested her palm against his own so that she could have taken it back from him at any minute, but she did not. Roxanne Koss knew the longer he held her hand, the more he would love her, and if he loved her,
He was more likely to try and protect her from the others. From himself. This particular boy looked impossibly young and fine-boned beneath the bill of his cap, his eyelids burdened by the weight of 1,000 silky black lashes. Across his narrow chest was a bandolier of bullets, and his body curved beneath their weight, the rough wooden handle of a primitive kitchen knife stuck up from the top of one boot, and a pistol was half falling from his pocket. Roxanne Koss thought of Chicago and the frigid nights of late October. If this boy had been living in another country, in an entirely different life, he might still have gone out trick-or-treating next week, even if he had been too old. He might have dressed as a terrorist, worn old boots from a gardening shed, fashioned a bandolier from strips of corrugated cardboard, and filled each loop with a tube of his mother's lipstick. The boy would not look at her, only her hand. He studied it, as if it were something completely separate from her. Under any other circumstances, she would have pulled it away from him, but due to the remarkable course of the evening's events, she kept her hand still and allowed it to be studied. The accompanist raised his head and glowered at the boy, who then settled Roxanne Koss's hand back against her dress and walked away. Two facts. None of the guests was armed. None of the guests was President Masuda. Groups of boys with guns drawn were dispatched to different corners of the house, down to the basement, up to the attic, out around the edges of the high stucco wall, to see if he had hidden himself in the confusion, but the word came back again and again that no one was there. Through the open windows came the raucous sawing of insect life. In the living room of the vice presidential home, everything was still. General Benjamin sat down on his heels next to the vice president, who was bleeding heartily into the dinner napkin which his wife, who lay beside him, pressed against his head. A more sinister edge of purple was now ringing his eye. It looked nowhere near as painful as the inflammation of his own face. "Where is President Masuda?" the general asked, as if it was the first moment they had noticed him gone. "At home." He took the bloody cloth from his wife and motioned for her to scoot away. "Why did he not come this evening?" What the general was asking was, did he have a mole in his organization? Did the president receive word of an attack? But the vice president was dazed from the blow and feeling bitter besides, bitterness being a first cousin to the truth. "He wanted to watch his soap opera," Ruben Iglesias said, and in the hushed and obedient room his voice traveled to every ear. "He wanted to see if Maria would be freed tonight." "Why were we told he would be here?" The vice president gave it up without hesitation or remorse. "He had agreed to attend, and then he changed his mind." There was an uneasy shifting of bodies on the floor. The people who didn't know were as appalled to hear it as the ones who had known all along. Ruben Iglesias had at that exact moment ended his own political career. There had been no great love between him and Masuda to begin with, and now Masuda would ruin him. A vice president worked hard because he believed someday the office would be handed down, like property, passed from father to son. In the meantime, he bit his lip, took the dirty jobs, the ceremonial funerals, visits to earthquake sites. He nodded appreciatively through each of the president's interminable speeches. But on this night, he no longer believed he would someday be the president. Tonight, he believed he would be shot, along with some of his guests, possibly all of his guests, possibly his children. And if that was the case, he wanted the world to know that Eduardo Masuda, a man barely one half inch taller than himself, was home watching television. The Catholic priests, sons of those murdering Spanish missionaries, loved to tell the people that the truth would set them free. And in this case, they were exactly correct. The general named Benjamin had cocked his gun and was prepared to make an example by dispatching the vice president into the next world, but the soap opera story stopped him. As much as he was sick to know that 5 months of planning for this one evening to kidnap the president and possibly overthrow the entire government were worthless, and he was now saddled with 222 hostages lying before him on the floor, he believed the vice president's story completely. No one could make it up. It was too petty and small-minded. General Benjamin had no qualms about killing. believing from his own experience that life was nothing more than excruciating suffering. If the vice president had said the president had the flu, he would have shot him. If he had said the president was called away on urgent matters of national security, he would have shot him. If he had said it was all a ruse and the president had never planned on attending the party at all, bang. But Maria, even in the jungle where televisions were rare, electricity sketchy, and reception non-existent, people spoke of this Maria. Even Benjamin, who cared for nothing but the freedom of the oppressed, knew something of Maria. Her program came on in the afternoons from Monday to Friday, with a special episode on Tuesday nights, which more or less summarized the week for those who had to work during the day. If Maria was to be freed, it was not surprising that it should happen on a Tuesday night. There was a plan, and that plan had been to take the president and be gone inside of 7 minutes. They should be out of the city by now, speeding their way over the dangerous roads that led back to the jungle. Through the windows, bright red strobe lights flashed across the walls, accompanied by a high-pitched wailing. The sound was nagging and accusatory. It was nothing, nothing like song.